Hello, I'm Peter Donat. In the first program of Transformations of Myth Through Time, Joseph Campbell took us back to the origins of our spiritual life in the great temple caves of early man. Through the magical animal forms that populated the walls of these sacred chambers, we were introduced to the earliest suggestions of mythic awareness, the revelation of the mystery of life. However, when pondering the lives of our primitive ancestors, outwardly there is scant evidence of a shared experience to connect us. We look to the caveman as the starting point from which to measure how far we have come. Yet from the earliest societies to the most recent, there is a continuity of a shared spiritual experience. Nowhere is the vitality of this experience more boldly expressed than in the mythologies of the American Indians, mythologies which brought the Indian into accord with his society and the natural world. Campbell begins this program by taking us through the stages of life all must pass on the journey from birth unto death.
Now, this picture that I've put on the screen is from W.B. Yeats, his curious and remarkable book, A Vision. And he has taken it from an alchemical work of the 16th century, Speculum Hominum et Angelorum, The Mirror of Men and Angels. What it represents is the cycle of the moon as a counterpart to the cycle of a human lifetime, with the 15th night of the moon corresponding to the 35th year of a lifetime. Using the terms that Yeats applies to this, we are born from the transcendent mystery, and immediately the society begins putting its imprinting upon us. The mask that we are to wear is put on us by the society. And Yeats calls this the primary mask. The eighth night of the moon is the night of adolescence and puberty. At that time, light begins to dominate over darkness. And so the attitude of dependency and submission has to be transformed now into one of maturity. There are two kinds of maturity, however. There's that of a traditional society where the individual moves over into the role of the authority which has been that of the society. That's say, he becomes the executor, the one who administers the rituals and so forth which carry the sense of the culture. He continues in the way of the primary mask. On the other hand, in our culture world, where we have a more open view, the individual at this time, when he may be able to have the sense of a destiny and world work of his own, of which the society had no notion, we begin to get a separating. The individual begins to find his own path, and the drag, you might say, of the primary mask is gradually thrown off. This is what is known as the left-hand path. The right-hand path is that of living in the context of the ideology and mask system, persona system, of one's local village compound. The left-hand path is that of the individual quest. Each of us is an individual. Earlier societies did not pay much attention to this. In our world, the individual, particularly in the European world, the individual is recognized as a positive, not simply a negative, power. And so there comes, in our world, the antithetical mask, the mask of the individual's own life, pulling against the other. Now, even where the youth is encouraged to find his own path, there is nevertheless a psychological lag, so this is a period of great tension. We are not reborn as easily as primitives or as people in traditional societies. We have a more complicated birth. We come then to the 15th night of the moon. Now the image here is of these two great lights the lunar light, which dies and is resurrected, dies and is resurrected, and the solar light, which is independent of the vicissitudes of time. At this moment, the moon and the sun are equivalent lights. Out on the plains, on the 15th night of the moon, at the time of sunset, looking to the west, you see the sun at a moment just resting right on the horizon. And if you look then to the east, the moon will be in the same position on the eastern horizon. I've seen it twice in my lifetime and both times mistook the moon for the sun. When lecturing on this subject in Oklahoma, I got the cry from the group of young people, so what's new? They see it every month. This is a moment of great mystical importance. Here your consciousness, your body, and its consciousness are at their prime. And you are in a position to ask yourself, who or what am I? Am I the consciousness, or am I the vehicle of consciousness? Am I this body, which is the vehicle of light, solar light, or am I the light? I once had the task of talking about these matters, talking about Buddhism, in fact, to a group of prep school boys, youngsters between the ages of about 12 and 17. And when it came to this problem of explaining what this Buddha consciousness or Christ consciousness was, I looked up the ceiling for an inspiration, and I found one. I said, look up, boys, at the ceiling, and you will see that the lights, plural, are on, or you might also say the light, singular, is on, and this is two ways of saying the same thing. In one case, you are placing emphasis on the individual bulbs. On the other, you're placing emphasis on the light. Now, in Japan, these two alternatives are called, respectively, the Jihokai and the Rihokai. Jihokai, the individual realm, Rihokai, the general. And then they say Ji, Ri, Mu, Ge, individual, general, no obstruction. Same thing. Now I say when one of those light bulbs breaks, the superintendent of buildings and grounds doesn't come in and say, well, that was my particularly favorite bulb. He takes it out, throws it away, puts another one in. What is important is not the vehicle, but the light. And I say, now looking down at all your heads, I ask myself, of what are these the vehicles? They're the vehicles of consciousness. How much consciousness are they radiating? And which are you? Are you the vehicle, or are you the consciousness? And when you identify with the consciousness, then with gratitude to the vehicle, you can let it go. Oh, death, where is thy sting? You have identified yourself with that which is really everlasting, this consciousness that throws up forms and takes them back again, throws up forms and takes them back again. And then you can realize that you are one with the consciousness in all beings. You are one with them. And you can say, GG Buge, individual, individual, no obstruction. This is the ultimate mystic experience on earth. That's the crisis here. So that's the death and resurrection here. The death and resurrection on the eighth night is to death to the infantile ego, birth to the mature. Here is death to the body, identification with the eternal aspect that lives in the body. And from then on, it's a wonderful thing to watch the body go, following the course of nature. Until the 22nd night of the moon, darkness begins to preponderate. The body becomes more and more submissive to the primary rules of the society and of nature. I remember one gentleman asked, when I was talking about this, what is it happens? I said, you'll find out soon enough. So, and then we have here these signs indicating the nuclear moment of the crisis. Temptatio, temptation, the cup of Tristan, Don, and Isolde. Not of Isolde and King Mark, the marriage arranged for by the society, but the awakening of the meeting of the eyes and the awakening of the individual destiny life and its realization. Then here, pulchritude, beauty, the glorious moment. I'm told that after the resurrection of the body, the last day, the joining of the body to the soul in heaven, we will all be 35 years old. So then we come on here to the decline and violence against yourself, holding yourself in form for the last lap. And finally, sapientia, the fruit, wisdom. Not a bad score. And so this also is part of the mythology of the body. The body going through its inevitable course, the long body. And here, a beautiful painting by a Swiss artist of the 19th century, Bicklin, Death playing the violin to the artist. That is the serpent bite on the Achilles tendon, which opens the two eyes. He is no longer just himself. He is the vehicle of the voice of the muse. Now I want to read a piece to you that for me epitomizes the sense of the early man in his relationship to nature. And this is a famous speech given by Chief Seattle, after whom the city of Seattle is named, around 1855. The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, every humming insect, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. We know the sap that courses through the trees as we know the blood that courses through our veins. We're part of the earth and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadow, the body heat of the pony and man, all belong to the same family. The shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you our land, you must remember that it is sacred. Each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. They carry our canoes and feed our children. So you must give to the rivers the kindness you would give any brother. If we sell you our land, remember that the air is precious to us, that the air shares its spirit with all the life that it supports. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also receives his last sigh. The wind also gives our children the spirit of life. So if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred as a place where man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow flowers. Will you teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother? What befalls the earth befalls all the sons of the earth. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. One thing we know. Our God is also your God. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? Where will the thicket be? Gone. Where will the eagle be? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt, the end of living and the beginning of survival? When the last red man has vanished with his wilderness and his memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, will these shores and forests still be here? Will there be any of the spirit of my people left? We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. care for it as we have cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land for all children and love it as God loves us all. As we are part of the land, you too are part of the land. This earth is precious to us. It is also precious to you. One thing we know, there is only one God. No man, be he red man or white, can be apart. We are brothers, after all. Okay. Compare that with Genesis 3. And you see what's happened. Furthermore, the land is the Holy Land, and the land where you are, not the land someplace else. Not only the body, but the specific landscape in which the people are dwelling is sanctified in these old mythologies. And you don't have to go someplace else to find the holy place. And that's the theme that I want to develop in this last part of my talk. I'm going to take as the model for this sanctification of the land the world of that we're in here, the world of the Navajo and the mythology of the Navajo and their sand paintings. And I just want to run through a little series of these sand paintings and the mythic matter associated with them. The people of Iceland have a term, land nam. This means land claiming or land taking. And land taking consists in sanctifying the land by recognizing in the features of the local landscape mythological images. Every detail of the Navajo desert land has been sanctified and recognized as a vehicle of the radiant mystery. This sand painting is called the Curtains of the Sky. And what you get are the four directions here, and colors associated with each of the four directions, and the center. The center, dark, the abyssal dark, out of which all things come back into which they go. And when appearances emerge, they break into pairs of opposites. This is all basic mythological stuff that we find in India. The sun rises here. It's the place of birth, of emergence, new life. When the Buddha achieved illumination, he was facing east. The New Testament is the testament of Sunday, the rising of the new eastern sun. Then in the height of the sky, the blue sky of noon. This is the midpoint, the 35th year of life. Then the west, where the sun sinks. And then the north, where the sun is going underground. And the north is always an area of awe and mystery and danger, the danger of that which has not been accommodated in the forms of the social order. And then, so we see the sun in these various aspects. Now, all of these mandalas that I'm going to be showing will be open to the east. Not closed, open to receive the transpersonal, the transcended light shining through. All things are to be transparent to transcendence. When a deity like Yahweh in the Old Testament says, I'm final, he is no longer transparent to transcendence. He is not, as the deities of the older cultures, a personification of an entity which antecedes his personification. He says, I'm it. And when the deity closes himself like that, we too are closed like that. So we're not open to transcendence either. And you have a religion of worship. Whereas when the deity opens, you have a religion of identification with the divine. And that was what Christ mentioned when he said, I and the Father are one, and he was crucified for it. Halaj said the same thing. And all of these are saying the same things. We're particles of that mystery, that timeless, endless, everlasting mystery which pours forth from the abyss into the forms of the world. Then you see the main plants of their sustenance. Just as the animal of the hunter, the animal that is the principal animal of his life, becomes the animal master, so when planting comes in, the main plants are sanctified also. There are Pueblo myths, and Huichol myths in Mexico, telling of the corn maidens. And one of them, in one of these myths, is compelled by the young hero's mother to grind the corn. And as she's grinding, her own arms disappear, and she disappears. She's grinding herself away. Our whole life is sustained by the mystery life. And everything that you eat, whether vegetable or animal, is a life that is being given to you through its own willingness to become your own life substance. So all of these mandalas that I'm representing here are going to be placed with the east at the top, and you'll see it's open. And then there are the guardians of the gate. In this case, they are a little figure known as Danso, big fly. I'm told that as one walks on the desert, sometimes a big fly comes down and sits on one's shoulder. This big fly is the counterpart of the Holy Spirit. It is the voice of the mystery, and it is your guide. And it can be called big fly, or in another aspect, little wind. And isn't this interesting? The wind, spiritus, the spirit. We got it in Chief Seattle's. That's an archetype, the recognition of breath as the breath of life. Now, this is one known as the buffalo. Just as the plants are sacred, and so the buffalo here. This is a buffalo mandala, and the surrounding horizon is of mirage. Two buffalo guardians at the gate, and people of the myth standing in the four directions, the central source with Dodso figures, and the main plants. These are the corn maidens of the four directions, the corn and the maiden. They appear either as corn or as maiden, again in the center of the dark with the crossing of the rainbow miracle. Now I want to go back to the main myth of the Navajo, and it's a Pueblo myth as well as the one that is universal in this part of the world. It is of the first people having come up from the womb of the earth through a series of four stages. And they go from one stage to another. Some accident happens in the lower stages. A flood comes as a punishment for an impropriety of some sort, breaking of a taboo or something of the sort. And they come on up. And finally, they come to the top level, the earth on which we are now. This is really an out-of-the-earth birth. And here's the ladder of emergence. And these are the first people with the plants and the animals round about that they discover here. And here is a special kind of mirage enclosing it. Now I must tell you, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, some many years ago, a team of Navajo singers came to show sand paintings and how they were made. And it was marvelous to watch these men take a colored sand in their hand and with great precision prepare these marvelous paintings. When they would prepare them, they would always leave out one detail. Now, when they're given to artists such as these have been given to artists to copy and then store in that museum of the Navajo art, something will be left out. That is to protect those who are dealing with the painting from its power. They're not supposed to have the power turned on. Well, they made one painting in the museum, and then they were asked, couldn't you just complete one painting, complete this one, for instance? And they laughed, and they said, if we finished this one, tomorrow morning every woman in Manhattan would be pregnant. So these things carry power. And then it was also interesting to watch them when the paintings were being destroyed, when they were being removed. They took that sand, and it was... The only thing I could think of was a Roman Catholic priest with the consecrated host in his hand. That is to say, there was sacred power here. And they were not just brushed off and thrown away. They were put in a special container to receive them and taken to somewhere else of which we know nothing. So here's the first part of the legend, the legend of emergence. Now, I said that in Iceland we have this context concept of land nam, land claiming. A specific place is identified on the reservation as the place of emergence. It wasn't the place of emergence. It is the ritual symbol of the place of emergence. And you can consider the emergence mystery when you address yourself to that place. Then there's the mountain of the north, and the mountain of the south, and the mountain of the east, and the mountain of the west. The land is consecrated. It is a holy land in this way. Where did the myth come from? It came with the people to that place. And then they consecrated the place in terms of the myth that was with them. Now I want to go through a specific legend. And this is the legend of where the two came to their father. These paintings I'm going to show now are not sand paintings, but pollen paintings, they're called. They're made of ground up corn and ground up petals of flowers and so forth and so on. When the Second World War started and the young men on the Navajo reservation were being drafted into the army, there was an old singer there named Jeff King. And a friend of mine, who now is living in Carmel, Maud Oakes, had gone down to the Navajo country to learn the legend lore and to make paintings. She was a competent artist of the sand paintings and so forth. Well, she had to really to seduce the old men into giving their stories to her. And the thing that persuaded them was the realization that the young men weren't learning these things anymore. These rituals are of one night, three nights, or nine nights. And the singer has to know by heart an extremely elaborate mythology and ritual system. And there must be no mistakes, and there's always a second singer to supervise to make sure that no mistakes are made in the chanting. Young men are not putting themselves to learn all this anymore. And so the rituals are dying out. And the plea was that if they would give to the modern anthropologist investigator this material, it would be stored and would be kept as a treasure in the museum there of the American Indian, of the Navajo. At that time, this is back in the 30s, the normal Navajo family is described as having been of a father, a mother, one child, and two anthropologists. The Navajo was a real hunting ground for the anthropologists at that time. Well, when a young man would be drafted, his family might go to old Jeff King, who had been a military scout for the American Army when they were fighting the Apache, Geronimo, and so forth. And old Jeff King, who died in the middle or late 90s of his years, is buried as a military hero in the cemetery at Arlington. Well, Maud got him to give her the rite that he was performing over the young men going into the army. It was an old warrior ritual called Where the Two Came to Their Father.